resurrection and rebirth, the god Thoth, the god of high magic and wisdom, the goddess Isis, Horus, the gods who came to Egypt bringing a knowledge of the divine origin of civilization with them and an understanding of how to live, of what life really means. And they encoded that in monuments, they hid it in chambers inside those monuments, and they passed it down through myth and scripture and culture, and it has reached us today, and it can still be understood.
What do we know about the contents of the secret areas of, for example, the Sphinx? What do we actually know about what's in there?
Well, one thing we know for sure is that licenses have been granted by the Egyptian government, by the Egyptian Department of Antiquities, involving a specific individual in that department, Zahi Hawass, who is the Director of Antiquities for the Giza Plateau. Licenses have been granted to two teams. Both of these teams are led by multimillionaires. One of them involves Florida State University. They are presently at the Great Sphinx of Egypt. They have $1 million worth of ground-penetrating radar and seismic equipment, and they are looking for chambers under the Sphinx. We already know and have known since 1993 that a large chamber exists at a depth of 25 feet beneath the front paws of the Sphinx.
All right, Graham,
that chamber was identified then.
All right, hold it right there. We'll be right back to you. Graham Hancock is my guest. Don't move. Graham Hancock. Graham, if they were to open up this secret chamber or a series of chambers and they found this great library of information from the past, it would certainly smash all kinds of scientific paradigms, no question about it, but would also, would it not, or would it, smash a lot of religious paradigms?
Yes, there is a deep religious mystery involved in all of this. And it concerns the meaning of human life, and this is the matter that we address perhaps most centrally of all in the message of the Sphinx. The ancient Egyptians believed that their civilization had been bequeathed to them, that it was a legacy of beings that they called the gods. And the ancient Egyptians believed passionately in life after death. Indeed, for 3,000 years, they devoted their best minds to the consideration of no other issue than the issue of whether or not human consciousness survives death. And they believed that there was a way of living, a certain way of living in balance with the universe, which they called the law of Maat, the law of universal justice and cosmic harmony, which it was necessary for us to follow if we were to attain life after death. They believed that the soul was the immortal essence and that the soul had been plunged into the material envelope, into the material form of the body, in order to undergo certain experiences that could only be had in the form of a human body. And indeed, they believed that a human body was a precious gift for the soul, but that we must not waste this gift. It's the view, certainly, of most Orthodox Christianity today that salvation is to be achieved only through faith, that blind faith alone is enough. We only have to believe, and then we will move on after death to heaven. This was not how the ancient Egyptians saw it. They believed passionately that life is an opportunity, a precious opportunity for the soul to learn and grow, and that our fundamental mission here is to acquire knowledge. Therefore, you might sum up their system by saying, not salvation through faith, but salvation through knowledge.
All right, but to be fair to the Christians, Graham, we are not without guidance. We have the Ten Commandments, we have the Bible, we have things that tell us how we should live to attain some sort of eternal position for the soul?
You know, I see a direct continuity between the ancient Egyptian wisdom tradition and the early, the pure, the original Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
But something bad happened to Christianity at around the time of Constantine the Great, when the Roman Empire, in its jackboots, hijacked that religion, turned it into a religion that in later times would burn people at the stake for using their minds.
Mm.
burn people like Giordano Bruno at the stake in the year 1600. Why? Because he said there is life on other planets. Because he said the universe is filled with life, and it doesn't make sense that our Earth is the only place in the whole universe with life on it. For saying that, and for saying that the Earth revolved around the Sun, which was a simple observation that had been made by Copernicus and that Giordano Bruno supported, this courageous man was burned at the stake by Christians. Christianity, through its hijacking by the Roman Empire and through the bureaucratic changes that were instituted in it at that time, became a religion of suppression of knowledge, in which knowledge was considered not to be a brilliant gift, but a danger, and anyone who sought after knowledge was seen as a threat to Christianity.
Indeed, the holding of books was a crime punishable by being burned, I think.
Indeed it was, and it was Christians, when they came to the New World, so-called Christians, who heaped up the manuscripts of the Maya, of that wonderfully civilized people of Mexico, of Central America, the Maya, heaped them up into piles 30 feet high and burned them in bonfires, thus wiping clean the memory banks of mankind in Central America, and who did the same thing in South America, destroying human knowledge simply because they felt that it conflicted with the teachings of the Christian faith, or should I say the Christian bureaucracy, because as I said a moment ago, if we go back to true and original Christianity, the beginning of this religion, the Gnostic Christianity, the Hermetic Christianity, we find a religion that's totally different, and that emphasizes the need to acquire knowledge, to use this wonderful intellect that God gave us, to use our mind, not to vegetate and blindly accept dogma from people who call themselves priests, but to use our minds and our initiative and our instinct and our intuition. And this was the central concept of the ancient Egyptian religion. The ancient Egyptians spoke of the equipped spirit, that the purpose of life was to perfect the soul, to perfect consciousness, to become an equipped spirit, and that the equipped spirit would then have the ability to navigate eternity, freely, well, like a bird.
All right, wonderful. So suppose these millionaires, with all their equipment, and then Graham Hancock and others, go over there and begin to acquire this knowledge, wouldn't the religious capitals and power centers of the world, if not burning you at the stake, Graham, do so in sort of a modern way? In other words, that knowledge would never, ever, ever see the light of day?
I'll answer that question in a moment. I want to say something a little further first, which is, it's important that listeners understand about this ancient Egyptian religious system and about why it offers something of extraordinary importance to the modern world, and about why indeed it would be suppressed by the powers that be. The ancient Egyptians spoke of a special region of the sky, and they called that region of the sky the Duat. It's spelled D-U-A-T when you transcribe it into our alphabet. And this region of the sky consisted of two principal constellations, the constellation of Leo, which I spoke of earlier,
correct,
and the constellation of Orion, which I spoke of earlier. On either side of the Milky Way, that the ancient Egyptians called the Winding Waterway. And what we're showing in the message of the Sphinx is that it is this region of the sky, this incredibly important region of the sky, through which the ancient Egyptians believed that the souls of the dead must journey after death and must undergo certain trials and ordeals for which their life was supposed to have prepared them. It is this region of the sky that is built on the ground at Giza, with the Sphinx replicating the constellation of Leo, and with the three great pyramids representing the three stars of Orion's belt. And the ancient texts, for example, the Book of What is in the Duat, which is inscribed on the walls of tombs in the Valley of the Kings in Upper Egypt, tells the initiate to do this. It says to the initiate, build on the ground a perfect copy of the hidden circle of the Duat, and know it. And through that knowledge, you may hope for eternity. And we think that's what they did. The hidden circle of the Duat is a reference to these skies, this area of the sky, hidden in time, hidden in the sky of 10,500 BC. And it is that sky that is built on the ground in the form of the Great Sphinx and the three great pyramids, with the Milky Way represented by the River Nile.
Let me see if I'm grasping this, Graham. They felt that that was the pathway the soul would take.
Yes.
In what manner would these precisely built structures aid the soul? In other words, is it sort of a...
They were a place of initiation. They were a place of preparation. They were a place in which the individual, the initiate, was immersed in darkness, in an underground labyrinth of corridors and passageways, to find his way, or her way, finally, to a place where an experience, where an encounter with a physical object, with physical records, with the books of the wisdom god Thoth, as all the ancient texts tell us, an encounter would take place, and there knowledge would be revealed to the initiate that would be the knowledge necessary to pass safely through the Duat after death. In other words, the ancient Egyptians believed that on death, unless one were properly prepared, the soul confronted a moment of terror and confusion and disorientation. And what they sought to do through the course of their lives was to prepare themselves for that moment so that they would be alert and awake and aware and ready to confront the challenges and the judgment that took place in the Duat. Because these were a people who believed that there was a reckoning and that everything we do in life is counted up, and that at the end of life, as we journey through the Duat, we confront that reckoning in a scene that appears painted on tomb walls that is called the judgment scene. But what it, when you translate the ancient Egyptian text exactly, they called this scene the weighing of words. And what you see is the soul in the judgment hall of Osiris, in one of these divisions of this strange parallel universe called the Duat. And there the soul confronts a great scale. And on the scales, in one pan, is weighed the heart of the soul, which symbolizes its immortal essence. And on the other is weighed the feather of truth. And the feather of truth must balance the heart. And if the heart is heavy with sin, or if the individual has wasted his or her life and never used it to accumulate experience and overcome challenges and difficulties, but just idled life away,
yes,
then the individual would face what they called the second death. And this was the ultimate end. Never ever to live again, never to come back, never to have the opportunity to perfect oneself, but simply to be annihilated and never live again. On the other hand, if life had been lived well, and if the spirit were equipped, then it would pass on into eternity, or at any rate be reborn and have an opportunity to live and learn those lessons again. And the system of monuments on the Giza Plateau, we have no doubt. We set out the evidence in depth in The Message of the Sphinx, but the system of monuments on the Giza Plateau was built to reflect the skies of 10,500 BC, to reflect the Duat region of the sky, to be a place of preparation and initiation, and to encapsulate and encode the knowledge of divine origin and the meaning of life that the gods brought to Egypt, as all the ancient Egyptian texts tell us.
How far are the Egyptians going to let us go? The electronics is going to go over there and look as hard as it can look. What about us going in?
Well, the biggest problem is human nature itself, and the biggest problem is the motives of the individuals who are presently working at this site. This story goes back to 1991 in its most recent incarnation, when John Anthony West, a very courageous man. For 20 years, John West has been trying to draw the attention of Egyptologists to the anomalous weathering patterns on the Sphinx, to the fact that the Sphinx was clearly exposed to thousands of years of heavy rainfall after it was carved. Finally, in 1991, he got Professor Robert Schock of Boston University, a leading geologist, to join him, and subsequently their findings have been supported by hundreds of geologists around the world that the Sphinx is vastly older than 2500 BC, because it was carved when the Sahara Desert was still green at the end of the last ice age, around 12,000 years ago. But that team also conducted seismic surveys around these Sphinx, and their seismic equipment identified a large, perfectly rectangular chamber buried in the bedrock at a depth of about 25 feet beneath the front paws of the Sphinx. As soon as they'd revealed this information to the public, they were kicked off the site by the Egyptian authorities, and by a particular individual whose name I mentioned before, Zahi Hawass, who is the head of the Egyptian of the Antiquities Organization with responsibility for the pyramids and the Sphinx. And they have never been allowed to return to continue their work. In the same year, in 1993, a German robotics engineer, Rudolf Gantenbrink, as I mentioned earlier, used a robot to explore the so-called southern shaft of the Queen's Chamber in the Great Pyramid.
Right.
And after a journey of 200 feet, discovered a door at the end of that shaft. And the same thing precisely happened to him. He released the information to the public, and he was kicked off the site and has never been allowed to return to continue his work. In 1995, realizing that he would never be allowed to come back, he offered to donate his robot to the Egyptian authorities and to train an Egyptian technician to do the job. And they wrote back to him and they said, "We're sorry, Mr. Gantenbrink, thank you for your kind offer, but we're much too busy at the moment, please go away." And there the situation rested for some time.
And
just
now,
this year, as we expose in the new book and as we've been trying to draw public attention to, a scandal has begun to unfold. Two multimillionaires, one of them American, one of them Canadian, working through, in the case of the Sphinx, the Florida State University, because you need to have a university on your side in order to get a license from the Egyptian authorities, have been granted concessions, one team to open the chamber under the Sphinx and to search for more, and the other team to open the chamber inside the pyramid. And this work is happening now, and greed and ego and a private agenda and absolute secrecy surround this investigation. Robert Bovall and myself were invited by the team working at the Sphinx to participate in their project. And this is a project that has been stolen from the original discoverer, John Anthony West. I mean, literally taken out of his hands by wealthy individuals and taken over by them. And these individuals asked myself and Robert to be part of their team because of our astronomical work, which pinpoints another chamber under the Sphinx. But they imposed two conditions on us. One was that we should write a letter condemning John Anthony West. This is like the Spanish Inquisition.
Mm-hmm.
And the other was that we should undertake to maintain absolute secrecy and not to reveal to the public anything that was found until the multimillionaire leading the team decided that he was prepared to reveal that information to the public. We
and
rejected
what
these absurd and outrageous
yes.
conditions, and we're campaigning for an independent inquiry to be undertaken as to what on earth is going on.
All right, the obvious question is, have they made a deal, a very specific deal with the Egyptian government regarding the flow of information?
Well, it's certainly the case that a deal has been made with somebody. The central figure who appears in both these projects is Zahi Hawass, the Egyptian Antiquities Authority's official with responsibility for the pyramids and the Sphinx.
Mm.
He has been involved in both of them. The team working at the Sphinx have been making a video film of what they've been doing. In fact, they've had a professional film crew from Los Angeles with them, and the initial filming was done in December last year, and the initial filming alone cost $100,000. And we have been leaked a 7-minute video cassette that was made by this team. And the video cassette is most bizarre. It appears to be a promotional, in fact, when it was sent to us, they said it was a promotional video cassette. It appears to be a promotional video cassette designed to hook a major U.S. television network into some kind of ghastly stage, live, televised opening of a chamber under the Sphinx at very large expense. And appearing in this video cassette, very oddly, because of something that the narrator of the video text says, the video cassette says, I'll tell you what he says. He speaks of an American psychic called Edgar Cayce,
yes.
who prophesied that the Hall of Records of the lost civilization of Atlantis would be discovered under the Sphinx in 1996. Appearing on this video, opening the video, in fact, is none other than our friend Zahi Hawass, this Egyptian official whose name I've been mentioning again and again, who's the man who controls the pyramids and the Sphinx, and who previously has spoken out very insultingly against Edgar Cayce and has condemned any notion that the Sphinx might have been built by survivors of Atlantis. And yet, mysteriously, this individual appears on this film entering a tunnel at the rear of the Sphinx, which cuts down towards the chamber that we've identified with our astronomical work, and who invites the viewer to follow him down into this tunnel. And he says, "Tonight, live on your television screens, we will open for the first time this tunnel that has never been opened before." What is going on here is truly extraordinary. This is not decent science. This is not work in which the public can expect to be told the truth. Some kind of hidden agenda is operating behind the scenes. Millions of dollars are involved in it, and we're not getting the straight scoop.
Brother. So you think there is a very public avenue they're going to follow altogether, too public and not scientific enough, and a very private and separate agenda.
Yes. The public avenue will come when it suits them to go public with the information. And in the meantime, they have absolute control and absolute secrecy over everything that they are doing. And what concerns us about this is whether, when they do finally choose to reveal information to the public, anything will be believed at all. The way that this research should be done from the beginning is under full public scrutiny, with no secrecy. It should be done completely out in the open, because these monuments are a legacy of mankind. And to have this secrecy going on, to have people being actually sworn to secrecy and not allowed to speak to anybody about what's happening there, the team who are working at the Sphinx have now been instructed not to speak to me or to Robert Bavall or John Anthony West or any of the others of us who are investigating this matter. To have this kind of secrecy going on, and yet at the same time to have some kind of carnival event being arranged for television in the next few months.
I think I get the picture, Graham. Hold on. We'll be right back to you. My guest is Graham Hancock. He'll be right back. This is CBC. We have been carefully laying out the science and the theory behind the incredible structures known as the pyramids and, of course, the Sphinx. And we're going to talk a little bit about the Ark of the Covenant as well. But I've got one sort of overall question for you, Graham, and we do have to get to the phones eventually here, and that question is, were they to open this up and there was no interference, mm-hmm. no secret deals, and we got the knowledge as it came out, what do you imagine, Graham, what do you imagine is in that material?
Hundreds of references that have come down to us in known Egyptian texts, in the ancient Egyptian Book of the Dead, in the so-called pyramid texts that were carved on the walls of later pyramids, not the pyramids of Giza, but pyramids from about 2300 BC at Saqqara, south of Giza, mm-hmm. the Book of What is in the Duat, the coffin texts, and others of these amazing ancient Egyptian funerary and rebirth texts tell us what will be found there. They tell us that it's an extraordinary secret, that it concerns the wisdom of the gods Thoth and Osiris. And Thoth was the god of high magic and wisdom. They called him the counter of the stars. He was known in later times by the Greeks as Hermes. And a tradition passes down from the earliest times in ancient Egypt up to the present day, a tradition that was somehow picked out of the ether by that American psychic Edgar Cayce, who spoke of the Hall of Records of Atlantis concealed under the Sphinx. And I've been speaking, by the way, of this American multimillionaire who's financing this so-called project at the Sphinx at the moment involving Florida State University. I have to tell you that this individual is a life member of the Association of Research and Enlightenment, which is the Edgar Cayce organization. Mm-hmm. And while I want to stress that I regard Edgar Cayce with the highest respect and also the Association for Research and Enlightenment with the highest respect, but that doesn't mean that, like any other organization, it doesn't have a few members who are loose cannons, particularly if they've got $100 million in the bank.
Mm.
This Edgar Cayce, I'm going to tell you what the Egyptian texts tell us is in those chambers, but I need to just give a bit more background first.
All right.
This Edgar Cayce organization, the Association for Research and Enlightenment, is a psychic organization, and normally Egyptologists and psychics mix about as well as polecats and chickens. Egyptologists deride psychics, and they insult them, and they claim that they're cranks and kooks and all of that kind of stuff. We were interested to discover that the leading Egyptological expert on the Great Sphinx, a man who is the voice of orthodoxy on the Great Sphinx, a man who has spoken out in many public fora insisting that the Great Sphinx was built in 2500 BC, the orthodox view,
yes.
and that it was simply a great statue to aggrandize the ego of a pharaoh called Khafre, a man whose work has been regularly published in National Geographic magazine, who's a pillar of the establishment, a professor at the Oriental Institute in the University of Chicago, Professor Mark Lehner. We were astonished to discover that his education at the American University in Cairo was paid for by the Edgar Cayce organization. and by friends of the Edgar Cayce organization, including certain millionaires, and that for many years after he graduated from the American University in Cairo, he continued having exclusive access to the Sphinx to carry out research projects financed by the Edgar Cayce organization and by the friends of the Edgar Cayce organization. Mark Lehner has admitted this to us, and we've published in The Message of the Sphinx an appendix, a letter from him, in which he admits this connection to us.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why we feel that the independent inquiry that is desperately needed into what is going on at the Sphinx and inside the Great Pyramid cannot be carried out by Egyptologists. We think that the whole discipline of Egyptology is compromised by what has been happening at the pyramids and at the Sphinx. Independent inquiry needs to be conducted, perhaps best of all, by the world's media. And in fact, we find that this compromising of Egyptology goes back a very long way. That we, in part of our book, in part two of The Message of the Sphinx, we look at Egyptology over the last 100 years and how it has systematically neglected and ignored crucial aspects of the Pyramid of the Sphinx, and sometimes even misinformed the public about what is happening there. For example, certain mysterious relics were found inside the shafts of the Great Pyramid, and this was never publicly announced. They were hidden away in a drawer in the British Museum until we unearthed them, and my colleague Robert Bavall was instrumental in that. An iron plate was discovered at the end of the mouth of the southern shaft of the so-called King's Chamber, a shaft that targets the lowest of the three stars of Orion's belt. This iron plate was discovered in 1837, deeply embedded in the masonry of the Great Pyramid and clearly contemporary with the building of the pyramid. Egyptologists refused to accept that it could be contemporary because it doesn't fit their paradigm of history. They believe that the Iron Age started in Egypt in 600 BC, and therefore an iron plate in a monument that is at least 4,500 years old doesn't fit their theory. Mm-hmm. So instead of making public knowledge about this mysterious discovery, they hid it away in a drawer in the British Museum, from which Robert and I unearthed it in 1993. There has been a systematic dishonesty about these monuments going on for a very long time, and we think that the entire discipline of Egyptology is compromised and thoroughly discredited by the way that it has handled research at this site. And this unfortunately comes to a head with this most important matter of the hidden chamber under the Great Sphinx and the hidden chamber inside the Great Pyramid. Just to close this story, I'll quote you from a recorded telephone interview that I did with the millionaire who's financing the other project. He's a Canadian millionaire, and he's financing the opening of the door at the end of the southern shaft of the Queen's Chamber.
Yes.
And he said to me, I'm working with a private guy who is a personal friend of Hawass, and that Zahi Hawass again.
Right.
And we are absolutely going to drum this thing to death. Whatever the event we are going to stage, it will be televised live. And he says that they're looking to raise $10 million from the United States television networks for this so-called live opening of the door. In other words, the Great Pyramid, the last surviving wonder of the ancient world, and perhaps its last and greatest secret, the contents of a hidden chamber, has been sold to the highest bidder. And this monument has been delayed for 3 years for reasons of human greed and ego.
Okay, having said that, Graham, at the same time, you called for media coverage.
Yes, we're calling for media coverage, but the research must be done openly and honestly. It can't be done. There must be no commercialization. There must be no hidden agenda. There must be no secrecy. Do you think a network is going to put $10 million into the opening of a door that they have no idea what is behind it? Wouldn't that be the ultimate anticlimax, the anticlimax of the century, if that door were opened and there was nothing behind it? They want to look behind there first. The secrecy that surrounds the research that is going on at the Great Pyramid and the Great Sphinx at the moment is so intense that nobody knows what's going on. These teams have exclusive access to these two matters. They are doing what they like with these monuments. The entry fee is large sums of money, and the public are not being told what is happening there. And this is what we're outraged about, and this is why we're campaigning for this work to be stopped dead in its tracks.
Mm-hmm.
The Egyptian government needs to be embarrassed into stopping this work. There needs to be a pause, and then new research needs to be started. A project has been proposed through Boston University and Princeton, and this project would be done in a scientific manner with full public scrutiny. And so far, this project has been entirely ignored by the Egyptian authorities, and we wonder why.
All right, Graham, if there is this great staged commercial opening, do you think it will be the first opening, or will there be a bit of a private pre-opening and extraction?
I think it's certain that there'll be a private pre-opening.
Yes, yes. But,
and I think it's possible that the mine will be salted. This is a this is perfectly possible under the present circumstances, and nobody will ever know the truth if these projects are allowed to continue in the present manner. This is what is so disturbing about this.
That's a very serious charge. The mine would be salted.
It is possible that the mine will be salted.
And
individual who, it is possible. I'm saying it's possible
right.
that it will be salted.
And what would you,
of the secrecy.
Yes, and what would you imagine they would salt it with?
Well, let me tell you that Zahi Hawass, the individual who has been involved in granting these licenses, recently made an announcement in the Egyptian press concerning the work that is being done around the Sphinx and the secret tunnels under the pyramid plateau. And he said that he expected them to find a large statue of the pharaoh Khafre there.
Mm-hmm.
The pharaoh who is favored by Egyptologists.
So you think it's being chiseled out as we speak?
I'll leave it to our listeners to make up their own minds on this matter. But unfortunately, the situation has just become so messed up by all these worst aspects of human nature, by greed and ego and secrecy and power, that we aren't going to get the truth unless the work is stopped and the project is started again in a clean and honest and open manner.
All right. There are many people who think that, for example, Rome, the Pope, has knowledge generally of what will be found, what is in there, what secrets are in there, some sort of general knowledge, and this has been passed from Pope to Pope to Pope. Is that possible?
Well, let me tell you what the ancient Egyptians said. They referred, as I mentioned earlier, hundreds of times to a great secret concealed there. And there was a kind of initiate quest that appears to have been undertaken by the pharaohs themselves, by the Horus kings of ancient Egypt, for this great secret.
Mm-hmm.
They spoke of the books of Thoth, the books of the ancient Egyptian wisdom god. And can I read you a couple of short passages from the ancient text?
Fire away.
In one of these, Thoth is known by his Greek name, Hermes. Such was all-knowing Hermes, who saw all things, and seeing, understood, and understanding, had the power both to disclose and to give explanation. For what he knew, he graved on stone. Yet though he graved them onto stone, he hid them mostly. The sacred symbols of the cosmic elements he hid away, carved by the secrets of Osiris, keeping sure silence that every younger age of cosmic time might seek for them. And in another passage, Thoth, the god of wisdom, speaks of his holy books that he has concealed at Giza. And he says, O holy books, who have been made by my immortal hands, by incorruption's magic spells, free from decay, throughout eternity remain and incorrupt from time, become unseeable, unfindable, for everyone whose foot shall tread the plains of this land, until old heaven doth bring forth meet instruments for you. What instrument, we wonder, might lead to the recovery of unseeable and unfindable secrets concealed at Giza? Could it be ground-penetrating radar, seismic equipment, a robot with a video camera mounted on the front of it? The last passage that I'll read you is just three lines long, and it speaks of the ancient name by which Giza was known, which was Rostow. And Rostow means, and it's very mysterious, it means gateway to the stars. This is the sealed thing which is in darkness with fire about it, which contains the emanation of Osiris, and it is put in Rostow. It has been hidden since it fell from him, and it is what came down from him onto the desert of sand. It means that what belonged to him was put in Rostow. Hundreds of references in the ancient Egyptian text speak of a great secret concerning the divine origins of their civilization, written records that refer to that time and that refer to the mystery of the meaning of life and of life after death associated with the god Osiris. I think that what's hidden there is a matter of extraordinary importance for mankind today, and that's why I feel so passionately and so strongly about what is happening at that site.
I understand. A contemporary caveat for you. Did you see a movie called Stargate?
Yes, indeed. I saw Stargate.
Good.
And I saw the first 12 minutes of Stargate, which are about the only minutes of the film that are really any good.
Uh-huh.
And in those 12 minutes, the researchers of that film had clearly got into the latest work, because they spoke of the connection with the Orion correlation.
Exactly, exactly.
And they spoke of the geological weathering of the Sphinx. So that film, in a way, was up to date. And we find it interesting that they called the film Stargate, because not many people know that Rostow, the ancient name for Giza, does literally mean gateway to the stars.
That was going to be my question, Graham. Might, along with whatever else may be there, might there in effect be a gateway?
We think that that this is precisely what the monuments are. They are a gateway to the stars. They are a gateway to this region of the heavens that the ancient Egyptians called the Duat. They're an interface between this material life and the life beyond death that the ancient Egyptians believed was experienced in that region of the sky through which the soul had to dwell, to travel. A physical interface, extraordinary monuments with a transformatory capacity on the human mind that can lift the mind out of the body, lift spirit out of matter, help us to realize what we really are. Yes, they are a gateway to the stars.
Should we have such a thing, Graham?
Well, we do have such a thing. And it was created with extraordinary intelligence and skill. And it was created for a purpose. And those chambers, so cleverly and cunningly concealed beneath the Sphinx and inside the Great Pyramid, were meant to be found so that every younger age of cosmic time might seek for them, as the ancient texts say.
Right,
they were meant to be found.
Right. Let me rephrase the question. Do you believe we're ready to find them?
I think if there were ever a time when mankind needed this wisdom that is hidden there, this legacy that the ancient Egyptians themselves inherited, this ancient legacy of wisdom and knowledge, that time, really, a power of evil is afoot in the world,
it's
which
true.
Is trying to persuade all of us that life has no meaning. And that's why there's so much viciousness and cruelty and hateful behavior in the world today. We need this knowledge. We need this wisdom now. And it is there, and people foresaw this long ago.
All right, Graham, hold on. It sounds to me a lot like what I call the quickening, economically, politically, socially. Every single avenue of human endeavor that you can measure these days is worsening, quickening, becoming harder to deal with, harder to understand. Life these days means increasingly less as events begin to move faster and faster. Faster. Graham Hancock, back in a moment. I'm Art Bell, and this is CBC. Back now to Graham Hancock. Graham, are you there?
Yes, I'm still here, fading
good.
Fast. It's getting close to 4 in the morning here, and I've got to get
sure
up in about 2 hours, but I'm still here.
Oh, my. All right, Graham. So all this incredible information may be below the Sphinx, may be contained yet in the pyramids. I have got to ask you about the Ark of the Covenant.
Yeah.
You believe that it is real, it is locatable.
First book in this series of books, and they are a series of books during which I have personally developed as a researcher and during which I've undergone transformatory experiences that have changed my whole way of looking on life. My first book that plunged me into this huge area of mystery was The Sign and the Seal.
Right.
Before that, I was a correspondent for The Economist. I was a hard-edged journalist. I was interested in politics, wars, famine, economics, that kind of stuff. And I was an investigative researcher. And just by the sheerest luck, by luck in my life, I came across the Ethiopian claim to possess the Ark of the Covenant. And this claim led me into the realm of mystery that brought me to the pyramids and finally to this story that we tell in The Message of the Sphinx and that I preceded with Fingerprints of the Gods. But the Ark of the Covenant was the beginning of it all for me.
Right.
And in order to follow up the Ethiopian claim to possess the Ark of the Covenant, I had to try to understand what this mysterious object really is. I had to go into all the ancient accounts that speak of it, the accounts in the Bible and many, many accounts outside the Bible. There are more than 200 references to the Ark of the Covenant in the Bible before the time of Solomon. And after the time of Solomon, it is almost never spoken of again. And all the references to the Ark describe a most extraordinary and mysterious object.
Would you, if you could, open it?
No, I would not. I would not. I have studied this matter very closely. I began to wonder what the Ark is, what it really is. When I came at last at the end of my long journey, which brought me through Egypt, across the deserts of the Sudan during the Ethiopian Civil War in 1991, and finally up into the highlands of Ethiopia to the city of Aksum, and at last to the monastery at the heart of which stands the sanctuary chapel in which the Ethiopians claim that the Ark of the Covenant is kept, I was determined to get inside that chapel and see the Ark. And then I encountered the guardian of the Ark, a single, pure, and holy monk whose responsibility it is to go before this object every day, to burn incense before it, and to offer prayer before it. And he spoke to me about the Ark, and the things that he told me made me quite certain that I didn't want to get inside. And even if I had wanted to go inside, I would never have been allowed. The city of Aksum stands at the heart of the Tigrayan rebellion, the biggest standing army in Africa, the tyrannical dictatorial army of the former dictator of Ethiopia, Mengistu Haile Mariam, was overthrown by the people of Tigray. And at the heart of the province of Tigray is the sacred city of Aksum, and it's a city which is guarded by fierce and independent people, and they would never allow anybody to get into that chapel on pain of death.
I understand, but I want to know.
But if I could get in there, would I open it?
And
no,
I
would not open the Ark.
Why not?
For two reasons. Firstly, because of the aura of sanctity and mystery that attaches to it, and in some matters I do not think we should dabble. And secondly, because this object, in all the descriptions, it comes across as immensely deadly, physically dangerous. I have now spoken, I've had the opportunity to speak with a series of guardians of the Ark in Aksum. They have a very short lifespan. Once they are appointed to this position, they rapidly become sick. They develop cataracts over their eyes. One of them, Tesfa Miriam, the one I interviewed at the end of The Sign and the Seal, Gebre Michael, who I spoke to in 1991, died a few months later. His position was taken by another monk called Tesfa Miriam, and I met Tesfa Miriam on three occasions over a six-month period, and we visibly saw him shrink in size, and we saw the cataract melt over his eyes and cover his eyes. And we asked him why, what was doing this to him, and he said, it's the Ark. It's the Ark of the Covenant that is doing this to me. We asked him how he felt when he'd first gone into its presence. He said, I trembled with fear, and I tremble still. And I said, why? Why do you tremble? And he just looked at me straight and level in the eyes, and he said to me, the Ark is a thing of fire. And all the ancient traditions speak of it as precisely that, an instrument of enormous power and deadly danger. I think it's another one of these legacies of a great lost civilization, a legacy of a science and a knowledge that we do not understand today. I found that there are descriptions of identical objects in ancient Egyptian tradition. One, for example, is called the Box of Ra, and Ra was the ancient Egyptian sun god. This was a golden box just like the Ark, and it was said to contain a series of objects, including a rod or a staff, which is also said to be inside the Ark. It was apparently hidden away in a fortress on the eastern frontier of Egypt. And thousands of years after the time of Ra, an Egyptian pharaoh sought to open it. And as they lifted open the lid of this box, a bolt of fiery energy shot forth from it, and everybody who stood around it was killed. Precisely the same thing happened again and again with the Ark of the Covenant in the Bible.
How are you sure, Graham, that going through that metal door at the Sphinx wouldn't leave one roughly the same way?
Because what is concealed there was meant to be found. Because these were repositories of records and traditions, not instruments of war and death. The Ark of the Covenant, in every description that has survived of it, sounds like an instrument that was designed to kill people. And that's what the Israelites used it for. That's what Moses and the Israelites used it for when they traveled to the Promised Land, when they knocked down the walls of Jericho with it. That's what it did to the Philistines when they briefly captured it. The Bible says the hand of God lay heavy upon the Philistines. This was an instrument designed to do damage and harm.
Indeed. Well, yes, but...
But the chambers under the Sphinx and the chamber inside the Great Pyramid were designed to contain records and tradition and information and secrets and wisdom. And these were intended to be found. You do not build a 200-foot-long shaft, 8 inches wide and 8 inches high, rising at an angle of 39 degrees through a 6-million-ton monument, leading to a door with two handles, unless it is your intention that at some time, at the right time, when the time is right, that that door should be opened.
All right. Quickly, the work of Mr. Hoagland regarding the monuments of Mars and how it relates to what we have here on Earth that we've been talking about tonight.
Well, the first point to make is that what we have here with the monuments of Mars is a testable hypothesis, and testable hypotheses are very desirable in science. Science is rests on the notion of ideas that can be tested out. And
indeed,
this is an idea par excellence that can be tested out. We do not need to speculate any longer about what those curious forms and patterns on the surface of Mars are, which appear to be a group of pyramids and the face of an enormous sphinx about a mile long, gazing straight up at outer space. These are first were shown in photographs taken in 1976 by the Voyager mission.
Yes.
And there is a possibility that the photographs are simply revealing tricks of light and accidents of erosion, and this is the NASA story. This is what NASA says. It's possible, let's face it, it's possible that that's what these things are, but it's also possible that they're artificial. And Richard Hoagland has put together an enormous amount of evidence which compellingly suggests that they are artificial. Now, I don't want to speculate about it. I want the work to be done. I want the research to be done. I want, and I think the American public would want, NASA to make sure that the two vehicles being launched and sent to Mars this year, one an orbiter and one a lander, take a close look at that area on the surface of Mars where these structures appear. These spacecraft are being financed by American public money. They belong to the American public. They do not belong to a few bureaucrats with fixed and rigid ideas. And I think the American public, in their masses, in their millions and tens of millions, would wholeheartedly endorse the use of these vehicles to closely re-photograph those structures on Mars, and the use of the lander to land at that point, which is called Cydonia, and to find out precisely what these things are. If they turn out to be just tricks of light and erosion, then if the experiment will still have been worthwhile, and we can draw a line under the matter and forget about it. But my goodness, if they turn out to be artificial structures, then everything changes. Our whole view of life in the solar system changes. Another great mystery opens up. And that's what we're supposed to be doing. That's what human curiosity and intelligence are for. We're supposed to be finding out what we are, why we're here, our place in the universe, and we should be looking with urgency and intelligence and curiosity. We should be looking with interest at these things and finding out what they are. And it stuns me that the bureaucrats at NASA have never allowed this further work to be done. I think it's extraordinary. I think it's bizarre. I'm not surprised that all manner of conspiracy theories have grown up about around this. It's an outrageous situation. These monuments should definitely be studied if they are monuments. Let's find out what they are.
Richard has renamed his mission, the Enterprise mission, to boldly go where someone has gone before.
Yes.
And that would make sense. Now,
Richard and I find a common ground not just on the matter of suppression of knowledge.
Yes.
At the Giza site and at the and in the issue of the monuments of Mars, but also in another intriguing possibility, that we may not be looking at the work of extraterrestrials here. We may be looking at a fingerprint of a distant, lost human civilization.
Yes.
That an earlier human civilization may have made the climb to the level that we have now reached, where it was capable of exploring neighboring planets in the solar system. And that earlier lost human civilization, spoken of in all the myths and legends of mankind, may have left those monuments on Mars, and that when we get there, what we'll find is ourselves. This is the possibility that haunts me. Again, I don't know if that's the case, but I think we should do the work. I think we should find out.
If you were to have to hazard a guess regarding Mars and the pyramids and the Sphinx and all the rest of it, what is your best guess? In other words, are the aliens us?
Well, I'm quite certain that the monuments on the Giza Plateau are us. This is the work of human beings, and this is the work designed to carry a great human knowledge and a great human secret. I do believe that these monuments are the legacy of a lost human civilization which knew things that we don't know and which understood the mystery of life
designed,
far better than we do.
Yes, designed by and built by humans?
Oh, yes, designed by and built by humans. I see no need to involve aliens in explaining these monuments on Giza. I think it's a good principle in science that if a simple and elegant explanation exists for a mystery, it is preferable to a more complicated and clumsy explanation.
And yet, it doesn't really. You articulated that in the beginning of the interview, that we really could not have built those things.
No, we could have built those things. We just have to abandon our prejudices and assumptions about the past of mankind, that's all. We just have to stop accepting the porridge that's handed out to us by our established academics, who insist on believing that our civilization is the only civilization that has ever reached a high level of development. We have to consider the possibility that we're a species with amnesia, that there is a forgotten civilization way back in our past that was every bit as advanced as we are, perhaps more so, that could do things that we can't do and that left its fingerprints all around the world. That's fingerprints of the gods. That's the message of the Sphinx. That's what my work is all about.
So we could have built those things, but only with the science that we do not today understand.
Yes. We're looking at evidence of something we do not understand here, but that doesn't mean that it isn't human.
When do you suppose, Graham, we will know the truth about the Sphinx? In other words, is it going to plow forth with this big commercial venture despite your protests?
I think that I see evidence all around me that public outrage about this matter is mounting. And I think that the Egyptian authorities are going to have to stop these outrageous projects that are taking place at the pyramids of the Sphinx at the moment. And I think they're going to have to consider the other applications for projects. As I say, a joint one from Boston and Princeton has been put in, and that one would be conducted with full openness and public scrutiny.
What is the timeline if we don't get it stopped?
The timeline, if we don't get it stopped, the clock is ticking very fast right now. These teams are working at those sites at the moment, and we don't know what they're doing. We don't know what is happening there. We don't know what may be being removed already from chambers under the Sphinx. We don't know what may be being put back into those chambers. All these are speculations, but anything is possible when research is being done under conditions of extreme secrecy. That's why I think it's essential that these projects get stopped fast, before this mess gets any bigger and any deeper.
Well, who stops it?
And the Egyptian government is the sovereign power in Egypt.
Yes.
They have the power to stop this if they want to do so, but they need to be persuaded. They need to be persuaded to stop it. Very powerful, wealthy individuals are behind these projects. They seem to have connections to certain high officials in Egypt, particularly the official whose name I mentioned earlier, Zahi Hawass, who's responsible for the pyramids and the Sphinx. And higher up figures in the Egyptian government have to take the necessary steps. This will happen if a public inquiry is called for, if the public of the world, if our mass media, all our television programs, so-called investigative TV, newspapers, endlessly regurgitate the standard Egyptological line. Let them consider that they may be looking here at a vastly bigger story than even the opening of Tutankhamun's tomb in the 1920s. That they should be, they have a responsibility to investigate this story. If they investigate it, if they put the individuals under the spotlight, if they ask them harsh questions and demand answers, if they inquire into this, then the veil of secrecy will be lifted and these projects will be stopped, and then we have a possibility for proper research to be done.
All right, should this be a matter beyond Egyptian nationalism?
Yes, it should be a matter beyond Egyptian nationalism. As many enlightened Egyptians have said, they are the stewards of these monuments, but these monuments belong to the entire world. They are a legacy of the whole of mankind. They belong to all of us. Egypt has the privilege and the honor to be the stewards of these monuments today, and they should look after those monuments well, and they should consider the meaning and the importance of those monuments, and that's why they should stop these ghastly projects at that site at the moment.
All right, Graham, I think we've done it, and it's getting close to time for you to get a little bit of sleep before you do whatever you're going to do next.
Indeed.
Where are you going to be? Where can people see you or hear you?
Well, I'm going to Dallas. I'm going to St. Louis. St. Louis, is that how I pronounce it?
Oh, that's close enough.
So I'm going to St. Louis first, and I'm going to be giving a talk tomorrow night, this night, because we're now already in Wednesday, aren't we?
Yes.
Wednesday, the 19th of June, at a bookshop called The Library Limited in St. Louis, between 7 o'clock and 8:30. That's at 7700 Forsyth Street, St. Louis.
Yes, okay.
That's on Wednesday, the 19th of June. And then on Thursday, the 20th of June, I'll be in Dallas, Texas,
right,
at Borders Bookshop, and I'll be giving a talk. Again, these talks are given with slides, and I give a detailed exposition of the content of the message of the Sphinx, and at all these talks, I make a detailed announcement, more detailed than I can do here on the radio for legal reasons, a detailed announcement concerning what is exactly happening at the pyramids and the Sphinx today as we speak. So the talk I'll be doing at Dallas will be between 7 o'clock and 9 o'clock at night on Thursday, the 20th of June, at Borders Bookshop, and that's 10720 Creston Road, Dallas, Texas. And so that's Thursday, the 20th of June, and then Wednesday, the 19th, I'll be in St. Louis at the Library Limited, 7700 Forsyth Street. And then I'll also be doing a talk in Los Angeles a few days later, and I'm just trying to dig that one out.
All right. Well, we're almost out of time.
Yeah, I'll be doing a talk in Los Angeles as well, but my publishers would be able to give the details. They're Crown Books in New York.
All right. Wonderful. Graham, it has been a pleasure, an absolute pleasure to have you on. I've been wanting to do it for a long time, and now it has been done.
Yeah, I'm really glad it happened, Art. It's been an excellent evening's conversation. I've very much enjoyed it. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Take care, my friend. Get some sleep.
Thanks a lot.
Graham Hancock. Told you we'd do that. Now we've done it. I'm Art Bell, and we will be right back.
You're listening to 790 KABC Talk Radio.